Well, the sixth case for argument this morning is the United States v. Seymour et al. Mr. Stroh.
Good morning to the court, to counsel. May it please the court, my name is Brian Stroh. I represent Stacia Smith in this matter. I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. With the court's permission, we've also reserved 2 minutes each for Mr. Brindley and Mr. Albers, who wish to speak on behalf of their individual clients' issues. I will be also arguing an individual issue on behalf of Ms. Smith, namely whether her Fourth Amendment rights were violated when she was denied a probable cause hearing. In addition, we have asserted a sufficiency of the evidence argument, which, unless this court has any questions on, I'm prepared to stand on our briefs in that regard. On behalf of all defendants today, though, I will be arguing the joint issue, namely whether the Sixth Amendment is violated when a drug quantity determination that is attributable to or reasonably foreseeable by each individual defendant is not made. In this case, there was no determination of foreseeability made by either the jury or the judge. And the government admits in its brief on page 43 that the court actually found that a determination of foreseeability was made. And I want to make 2 points about this. The first is, by stating that a determination of foreseeability was made, it implicitly concedes that one needs to be made in the first place. And the second is that the statement that a determination was made is flat wrong. There is no evidence anywhere in the record in this case that a determination was made by any party, whether it is the judge or the jury. And indeed, the government cites to nowhere in the record when it makes that statement on page 43 that such a finding was made. Under the Supreme Court's precedent in Apprendi...
43 of the government's brief?
Yes, Your Honor. It says that the court found that each defendant was responsible, and then it goes on to discuss an amount of drugs. Under the Supreme Court's precedent in Apprendi, and as most recently clarified in Cunningham, the language is that any fact that exposes a defendant to a greater potential sentence must be found by a jury and not a judge. Under Cunningham, the words exposure to potential sentence have become part of this analysis. And in this case, because the defendants are sentenced under Section 841, Sections A, B, and C, the only fact that changes the potential range of sentence that they face is that fact, drug quantity. Under Section C, the maximum potential exposure for each of these defendants is 20 years. Under Section B, the maximum potential exposure is 40 years. And under Section A, the maximum potential exposure is life. Under the language of Cunningham, which claims to clarify the previous Supreme Court precedent in Apprendi, the word is maximum potential exposure that these defendants are exposed to. We believe that that determination can only be decided by the jury. In this case, Your Honor, we also contend that even if this court were to follow its previous holdings in United States versus Knight and some of the other cases, that it is appropriate for the judge to make such a determination. It is not clear, as I stated, that that determination was made whatsoever. Though the government does claim that that determination was made, it appears that the judge was under the mistaken belief that he was required to sentence each of these defendants under Section A instead of Section C, because, as he stated, the law, as the jury has found, states that I must sentence you to a particular range. And he said that in some of the sentencing hearings that were held for some of the defendants in this case. In reality, if United States versus Knight is still good law in the wake of Cunningham, and we would encourage a reconsideration of that, but even if it is, the judge is free to make a preponderance finding based on what the judge believes is attributable to or reasonably foreseeable for each of these defendants. And in that case, the judge would not be making a sentence based on what the jury found. The judge would be making the sentence on based on what the judge found himself. If the judge had made that foreseeability determination or the attribution determination, then the judge's statement would have been, I will sentence you based on what I have found. Instead, the judge believes that he has to sentence each of these defendants under Section A. Moreover, the government claims on page 30 of its brief that all defendants are responsible for the entire quantity involved in the conspiracy in this case. What that does, Your Honor, is it completely skips the step of the determination of reasonable foreseeability. That is not the law in this circuit. No matter what we decide in terms of who is to determine whether or not these amounts were foreseeable by each of the defendants, whether it's the jury or the judge, the simple fact is that determination has to be made. And it is not true to say that the entire amount found by the conspiracy as a whole automatically is attributable to or foreseeable by each of the individual defendants. That's why the case law in this circuit about conspiracy law focuses on what the determination of the scope of the conspiracy is for each of the individual defendants and therefore determining within that scope what was foreseeable. Under the conspiracy law, you're responsible for what you do and what you can reasonably foresee others doing. But if that step is skipped, as the government apparently contends, then we're automatically attributing the entire amount of a very broad and complex and long conspiracy to every member of that conspiracy.
And what language in Knight supports that approach, Mr. Strong?
The language in Knight, Your Honor, is that in the wake of Apprendi, the judge then must make that finding by a preponderance of the evidence. And we contend, as we stated, that that finding was never made by the judge in any of the sentencing hearings regarding each of the six defendants in this case.
Can't we infer that the judge made that based on his having sat through the trial? I assume this was a lengthy trial.
It was.
A great deal of evidence of the colossal scope of this conspiracy running over 10 years, involving 24-hour-a-day split shift drug transactions, highly organized, and each of the individual defendants on this appeal, anyway, played a substantial role in this conspiracy. Can't we infer that the judge understood what his legal obligations were at the time of sentencing and made that foreseeability finding, even if the record doesn't show that he pronounced the word foreseeable?
Your Honor, I think the judge's own words actually indicate that that isn't the case. The judge felt that, according to the facts that the testimony that he heard, that he wanted to give certain defendants low sentences. In fact, he told my client that he was giving her a sentence a fraction over the minimum. He felt bad about the sentence that he was going to give, and he made statements about the differing roles for each of the defendants over the course of the conspiracy. So I think the judge's own words actually indicate that the idea that there might have been overwhelming evidence or substantial evidence with regard to each of these defendants is not correct. And that's why the actual determination of foreseeability needs to be made, because as you state, a very complicated conspiracy, decades long, as some have alleged, a 24-hour-a-day conspiracy. If the amounts of the conspiracy as a whole are such and are large, as they were in this case, and they are automatically attributed to all of the defendants in their entirety, it completely forecloses whether or not one of the defendants could have been a completely minor player. It completely forecloses whether or not one of the defendants could have come in a very narrow scope of foreseeability.
Well, there wasn't any evidence to support that theory of the defense here, that any one of these defendants was a minor player. They had varying roles, but none of them was a minor player for a limited duration.
I would submit that certainly all of the defendants were involved in differing durations. And the judge also points out that there were different – he viewed the defendants differently. In fact, with regard to my client, he actually said that he believed that she fell in love. She chose to fall in love. She did not choose to become a drug dealer. So
he's a romantic soul, the judge.
He may be, Your Honor. But again, the larger point is simply that if we skip the step to determine the foreseeability of each of these defendants, then we are not following the circuit's precedent. Moreover, I might add that under McIntyre and some of the other cases that this court has heard in the last 10 years or so, the lack of a detailed finding as to why the judge made a choice to sentence each of these defendants under Section A as opposed to Section C can constitute error. And we would submit that the judge, at the very least, needs to rehear this case to resentence and give specific findings as to whether or not each of these defendants should be under Section C, Section B, or Section A.
Well, this case is factually a lot closer to Jarrett than to McIntyre. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would agree with that,
and
Your Honor.
Jarrett's more recent.
It is more recent. I would simply submit that the evidence that the government points to that allegedly establishes the roles of these defendants is not clear, and as we contend in our reply brief, in some cases is misstated and overstated with regard to certain conversations that occur behind houses as opposed to in houses, conversations that occur amongst certain defendants but not all defendants, and the government contends that conversation apparently was imputed, the knowledge that was contained in that conversation was imputed. So the record is not clear, and that's why in this case we're looking to the judge to make those specific determinations as to what he found credible and what the context of those conversations were, and therefore what his determination was with regard to reasonable foreseeability.
I have a chronology question. As I understand it, the case was tried pre-Booker, but sentencing occurred post-Booker.
That's correct,
and
Your
so
Honor.
The guidelines were applied in an advisory fashion.
That's correct.
We don't have any argument, kind of post-Booker argument of that nature.
We are not alleging that the judge relied on the guidelines exclusively and therefore under Booker committed an error. We are simply saying, though, that as Cunningham has recently stated, that the language here is exposure to potential. And the actual sentence that was chosen to be given by the judge in this case is not part of that analysis. Rather, instead of exposure to potential, the court would have said it would be the actual sentence that was granted under that. And that's the point we're making under Apprendi and Cunningham. Another point to make with regard to Knight and its applicability to this case is that it is worth noting that in United States versus Knight, it was a relatively simple conspiracy. There were three defendants. It was relatively easy to determine each of their roles within the conspiracy. The evidence also in that case was relatively overwhelming. Knight was the first time that this circuit had been asked to determine a case of that type in the wake of Apprendi, and it looked to the First Circuit, which had determined in United States versus Derman a similar approach, that the judge making a determination was sufficient for Apprendi purposes. It's worth noting, though, that Derman was also a very simple conspiracy with only a handful of defendants, and the First Circuit itself has questioned its approach in Derman in United States versus Nelson Rodriguez when it stated that the Derman approach would, quote, break down, and it could foresee it breaking down, in a case of a complicated conspiracy involving multiple defendants, involving differing roles for each of these defendants. And, Your Honor, we would present to you that this is exactly the case, factually, that the United States versus Nelson Rodriguez predicted would occur. The First Circuit hasn't been asked to determine a case of that factual scenario, and neither has this court, and we would submit that that's an additional reason to investigate Knight's applicability in this regard. Unless there are any other questions, I'd like to address Ms. Smith's Fourth Amendment argument, Your Honor, and it can be addressed relatively briefly. We contend that there was an error in violation of her Fourth Amendment rights when a probable cause hearing was not held with regard to the January 2002 stop. The government actually concedes that a determination needs to be made in this case with regard to whether or not the evidence that supported the January 2002 stop was sufficiently attenuated from the October 2000 stop. And the record in this case is a little muddled, and I'll do my best to clear this up. Before the trial, Ms. Smith's trial counsel filed a motion to suppress the January 2002 stop, which is where the gun was found in her car. The government responded a month later in January of 2003, and in that response, the government actually stated that the reason the police had probable cause in that case was specifically that in October of 2000, she had been pulled over. And because of that stop, she was a known co-conspirator within this conspiracy. Armed with that evidence, Ms. Smith's trial counsel in March filed a reply, and as part of that reply also moved to suppress the October 2000 stop, because they had not previously known that. The judge denied the motion to suppress the January 2002 stop in June of 2003, and it wasn't addressed again until first day of trial. Government counsel at the time suggested to the court that there still was a pending issue with regard to the October 2000 stop, and in fact, trial counsel for Ms. Smith had submitted an affidavit that created a factual issue. And Judge Anderson did finally hold a hearing with regard to the October 2000 stop, and after hearing the evidence on the case, decided that he was going to throw out the October 2000 stop and decide that that was unconstitutional. But it is worth noting that when he denied the January 2002 stop, the primary basis for denying that stop was saying that Ms. Smith was a known drug conspirator because she had been pulled over 15 months earlier. When the October 2000 stop was thrown out, there was no mention of the January 2002 stop. There was no mention of it being reconsidered, and in fact, it wasn't until a week later when Ms. Smith's trial counsel brought the issue back up in the context of a motion for mistrial. The trial counsel specifically said, Judge, you relied on a piece of evidence that you now have said is constitutionally tainted, and you said that was the primary basis for your decision. You need to look at that again. And the judge said, we will take that into consideration when we look at this line of cases. Here's what we do know. We don't have any evidence to establish that he did do that. We do know that, number one, he did not hold a subsequent hearing to determine whether or not probable cause existed for the January 2002 stop. And secondly, we know that he issued a one-line ruling saying the motion for mistrial was denied. In his June ruling, before the October stop was thrown out, he said, based on all of this evidence, I find that probable cause existed. And, Your Honors, we're submitting that based on some of this evidence, and in fact, based on a very little of this evidence, we're entitled to a hearing to determine how far the taint of that October 2000 stop extends, not only into the January 2002 stop, but into any other evidence that may exist.
Why would that be necessary? Probable cause is de novo review. We've got a well-developed factual record on what precipitated the stop, even excluding the 2000 stop that the district court found to be unconstitutional. What was bad about the probable cause that existed, excluding that evidence?
Well,
the cops had intercepted the phone call from the boyfriend who's, a leader in this drug conspiracy organization, and they know that. They know that she's involved as well. That's his girlfriend, and she's running a stash house, and it's the call in the middle of the night, and he's telling her to get up and put some clothes on and bring him that thing in his black box in the closet, you know what I'm talking about. And so she does. And, you know, that's enough suspicion to pull over the car. They don't need probable cause to pull over the car. All they need is reasonable suspicion. That's plenty. And then they see the box in plain view on the passenger seat.
There's certainly no issue with regard to the plain view, Your Honor. We're simply contesting the reason that they pulled her over in the first place. And there's two things. The first is we don't know how far the taint of the October 2000 stop extended with regard to what the police knew about Ms. Smith and what her role may be within this conspiracy. We do know that that was the first basis upon which they decided that she was an alleged co-conspirator. And it's the primary basis for both the judge's decision and the government's response to the motion to suppress.
It's 2 years later. It's kind of hard to argue that there's still a taint.
Your Honor, that may be very well true, but the next point is that there are two conversations. The two remaining pieces of evidence are a phone call that is asking Ms. Smith to make a delivery to a third party, and then a phone call between two people who have a relationship where he is asking her to bring a black box. And she actually says, in my closet, she's not actually sure where it is. Our suggestion is simply that there is not a sufficient enough relationship between the nature of those two calls to warrant a probable cause.
But the standard would be actually reasonable suspicion for the stop, right?
That's correct.
They don't need probable cause.
That's correct.
So an innocent explanation, when there's a not-so-innocent explanation, doesn't really matter.
That may be the case, Your Honor. For the rest of my time.
Good morning. Dan Albers on behalf of Andre Lawrence. Counsel, may it please the court. Judge Sykes, I'd like to answer your questions with respect to Andre Lawrence. First, Judge Anderson did say in his sentencing of Andre Lawrence, and if you look at the attachment to my individual brief, that he was less involved, in fact, one of those lesser involved, with respect to the conspiracy. So I would say that there is a difference, and I'm not casting aspersions on my co-defendants, but there is a difference with respect to what roles each played in the conspiracy. And as far as the time frame, the allegations and the proof as to him were that he possessed a stash house on Claremont for about a year and a half of what's been characterized as a 10-year conspiracy. So there is a big difference with respect to the individual defendants, and that's why it's important that the court go through what's required, which is to make specific findings after the conspiracy determination as to the amount of drugs reasonably foreseeable to each defendant. In my client's case, that means the difference between a 30-year-to-life sentence under the guidelines versus 0 to 30 would be the determination if it was less than 50 grams, and that determination was never made by a jury. So there is a specific constitutional impact. And the cases I've cited are if the court believed that it was 30 to life as opposed to 0 to 30, and he gave 25 years here, he may have believed then if it was 0 to 30 that he was entitled to much less than that. And when he's operating under the wrong range, that does have a constitutional impact.
Well, if he's running a stash house for a year and a half, 24-hour operation. I can't remember what the daily quantity of drugs would have been under the evidence that was introduced in the case. Does that add up to the amount that was attributed to him?
I don't know, Judge. The evidence was, with respect to my client, nobody ever saw him packaging the drugs. There was only one specific incident.
That's not necessary. If he's running the stash house, they don't need a witness who pinned it on him. He was convicted of the conspiracy, involvement in the conspiracy, at least to that extent. And so if you can attribute knowledge of a daily drug sale amount over a year and a half, and that adds up to more than the 1.5 kilograms, which was attributed to him, then that's enough.
And it wasn't attributed to him, Your Honor. That's the problem. It was attributed to the entire conspiracy. The judge
reasonably
never
foreseeable
made a finding
to him.
The judge never made a foreseeability finding as to him, and that can't be inferred. Case law is clear on that. There has to be a specific finding, specific factual statements as to what the basis for that was in order to find that, in order to support the sentence. So you ask that question, can you infer that? And my response to that is you can't under the Seventh Circuit case law that we've cited. The other issue, which I really wanted to address in my 2 minutes, and I hope you'll indulge me, is the gun charge. The additional 5 years that my client got was a possession and furtherance of the conspiracy. And I think to frame the issue, the government said in its closing statement, quote, it goes without saying the guns were discovered in the stash house possessed by Andre Lawrence to protect the organization, money, and the drugs, unquote. But it doesn't go without saying. The case law is very clear, but from this court, based on the Bailey Supreme Court decision, the Castillo case in this court, that there has to be a specific nexus between the possession of the gun and the furtherance of the conspiracy and all of the drug activities. And all they proved here was that he had a gun. They never related it to the drugs. And if you look at each of the factors that Castillo adopted from the Ceballos-Torres case in the Fifth Circuit, the type of drug activity, the accessibility to the weapons, the type of weapons, whether they were stolen, whether they were legally or illegally possessed, whether they were loaded, their proximity to any drug-related activity, and the time of circumstances when they were found, none of that supports any relationship between the possession of the guns and the drug activities.
Wait a minute. I thought the guns were found stored with $4,000 in cash, a bulletproof vest, and drug bagging supplies. Is that not
right? That is correct. They were found at least a half year after the last evidence of any drug activities in the house. So that's kind of a post hoc ergo propter hoc argument that because they were found then, therefore they must have been there when the drug activities were going on. That relationship was never established. And the critical fact that the courts have found where they've supported this kind of conviction is were they found with drugs. And they were not found with drugs. There were no drugs found in the house when the guns were recovered. So there is no evidence to relate them to drug activity. And the court, what you're suggesting is draw the inference, well, the guns were found at this time and there was drug activity before, therefore they must be related. And the cases have said, no, there has to be specific evidence to relate those two.
Bagging supplies?
I'm not saying there wasn't evidence that at some point in that house there was some activity going on, but they didn't connect the guns to that activity. They never did. There's no such evidence, and that should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Alvarez. Mr. Brindley?
Please, the court. For the record, Beau Brindley on behalf of Mr. Kent Clark. Your Honors, with respect to Mr. Clark, the apparent lack of a specific foreseeability finding is probably and perhaps more damaging than to any of the other co-defendants. Had a specific foreseeability finding been made with respect to Mr. Clark, then the evidence surrounding Mr. Clark with respect to drug quantity would have been, at the very least, scrutinized much more closely by the judge. The judge apparently believed he had to, by his own admission, sentence everyone according to the finding of the jury. But if he'd made a specific finding for Mr. Clark, then he would have noted and been able to make a decision based on the fact that there's not a single instance in which any of the witnesses who testified in this case ever gave a specific assertion about Mr. Clark doing anything that would allow them to come to a quantifiable drug amount. The only testimony from witnesses against Mr. Clark was testimony that would in fact indicate that he held some vague position, that they heard that he held some vague position, but not that he ever took any action that would allow anyone to infer a specific drug quantity. And with that evidence, Mr. Clark should have been, if a foreseeability finding specific to Mr. Clark had been made, then he should have been subject to a guideline range far less than the extraordinary range to which he was subjected at his sentencing. And he is entitled to a sentencing in which he can be subjected to that range and to a decision by a judge who believes that he can make a specific foreseeability finding based on the evidence against Mr. Clark and based on the evidence illustrating the quantity that Mr. Clark, and only Mr. Clark, was responsible
for. Mr. Brindley, what could the judge drawn from Mr. Stewart's testimony about Mr. Clark as a runner?
The judge could have, well, from that testimony, he could have withdrawn, I guess, the inference that Mr. Clark at some point had run. Whether he was a runner for drugs or runner for money is not that clear. And more importantly, Your Honor, a quantifiable amount would be really hard to figure out based on that vague assertion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Brindley. Mr. Dolier.
Good morning, Counsel. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Steve Dolier, and I represent the United States of America in this matter. Three of the defendants raised joint arguments with respect to an Apprendi issue, as well as certain individual issues. Let me start with the Apprendi argument. And I think at oral argument today, there was a blurring of the lines between what's required under Apprendi and what's required at a sentencing. And as this Court's established precedent makes clear, is that under Apprendi, in a conspiracy case, a drug conspiracy case, jurors must make a finding as to the conspiracy as a whole with respect to drug type and drug amount. The record is equally clear here that that is exactly what the jury was asked to do and did do in this case by making a finding that this conspiracy involved over 50 grams of crack cocaine. And as I'll get to in a second, 50 grams of crack cocaine in this case is a drop in the bucket. But as far as Apprendi, in Knight, the court made very clear what's required of the jury is to make that initial finding, and that sets the ceiling. In this case, it's life imprisonment. A couple of these individuals, actually five of the six, I believe the defendants appealing here, have 851s. Troy Lawrence has two, so you're looking at Troy Lawrence as a mandatory life imprisonment. Four of the other defendants have 20 to life as their range. But by finding that it involved crack and involved 50 grams of crack cocaine, they set the ceiling. Then in Knight, this court has gone on to explain that then it's the judge's responsibility to set the floor, the amount that's reasonable, foreseeable to each of the defendants involved in the conspiracy. And again, that's what happened here. Knight was a 2003 case, fairly recent, but however, there's the two 2006 cases, Tolliver and also Jones, in which this case looked at drug conspiracies again and found that Knight is good law. You've heard a fair amount about the Cunningham case, which is a recent Supreme Court case, and really the only novel part of Cunningham is that it's an Apprendi case that reached the Supreme Court. The government would submit that if it was rightly decided in the Ninth Circuit, it probably wouldn't even have been cited in the briefs in this case. And just quickly, what it involved was you have a California basically penal statute that has three levels of sentencing in a child exploitation statute. You have a low, medium, and high. And based on the jury's finding, it was medium. But the statute allowed the judge to make extra findings in which it would kick it up to the high level, which would be an extra penalty beyond the statutory maximum as found by the jury. That's not what happened here. Here, the statutory maximum was found by the jury as the conspiracy as a whole, which is 50 grams. So you have your maximum sentence set. So there's no reason to depart from the Seventh Circuit. Clearly established precedent in this case. And as Judge Sykes, you pointed out earlier, there's ample evidence that it involved, on a harmless error analysis, that it involved far more than 50 grams of crack cocaine as to each of the defendants. Now, moving on to their second argument, which ties in somewhat to a harmless error analysis that the government has done in connection with the Apprendi issue. The judge at sentencing basically made a finding that the conspiracy at each individual sentencing said that it involved 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. As the defendant points out, he did not use the words foreseeable to. But as Judge Sykes, as you pointed out again, he had sat through a three-month trial in which the roles of each of these defendants was laid out in great detail. And I can get to in a second that under any analysis, a judge clearly did not err. It didn't err at all in making that 1.5 kilogram finding. But as you look at the evidence, 1.5 kilograms, the judge even recognized this, was a small amount of crack cocaine involved in this conspiracy. And I can point the court to the evidence that shows that. You have a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-days-a-year drug conspiracy out of Chicago Heights run by Troy Lawrence from the early 1990s to 2002, which was when the takedown took place, March of 2002. You have evidence from Darren Stewart, who was a pack man at Wentworth Gardens, which is where the drug spot was up until 99 when they condemned Wentworth Gardens and they moved their conspiracy to Claude Court, which, by the way, was 1,000 feet away from a grammar school. When they were at Wentworth Gardens, Darren Stewart said that he would sell approximately $20,000 worth of crack cocaine. And in this conspiracy, there's evidence at trial that shows $1,000 of crack is an ounce of cocaine, which is 28 grams. So if you do the math, you're basically reaching 1.5 kilograms in 3 days, just based on him, just based on Darren Stewart being a pack man. But as you see in the government's brief, it's not just one individual out there. It's approximately 15 people at the drugs involved in the conspiracy, not necessarily at the drug spot. But you have a pack man who's watched over by a shift supervisor who then takes the crack cocaine from a runner. The runner brings the crack cocaine to the shift supervisor who passes it down to the pack man. And then they sell it to the pack, which is the people who are buying the crack cocaine. When you go over to Claude Court, you have Griffin, who was a runner, who would bring the crack to the spot. He testified that he would bring crack to the spot 2 to 4 times a day, and each time he would deliver, or he would deliver in a day about $4,000 to $10,000 a crack. Now, if you think, if you just take him, these two individuals, Griffin now at Claude Court, you're reaching a kilogram of cocaine in 10 days. So an individual did not have to be in this conspiracy for very long to reach that 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. And with that in mind, and just pointing out briefly, they didn't start dealing in less amounts either. As you see in 2002, right before the takedown took place, within a 2 or 3 day span, the government seized 227 grams of crack, already packaged up, ready to be sold at the spot from Tasha Deer, who was a runner for the organization, and 211 grams from Cam Wilson, who was also running crack for the organization. You forward also into 2002, the government did a search on Tasha Deer's apartment, almost 300 grams of crack cocaine. So it was a huge amount of crack cocaine involved in this conspiracy. And to find that each of the defendants specifically raised at oral argument here with respect to Ken Clark, Andre Lawrence, and Stacia Smith, they were involved for not a short period of time, but rather a very long period of time and had significant involvement. And because it was raised in detail as their involvement, I can point the court to the record. Griffin, for instance, identified Ken Clark as a shift runner. Now, a shift runner is also a shift supervisor, and this was at Wentworth Gardens. So Ken Clark was the person standing at the drug spot passing out the crack cocaine to the pack men. He would take it, obviously, from the runners and then pass money off to the runners. And you even have Leverett Griffin estimating that he'd usually give him a pickup of about $4,000 or $5,000 from Ken Clark when he went down there. You also have Green Salas, who said that Ken Clark was a shift runner for the organization. And Green Salas was a shift runner himself and actually participated in this conspiracy from the early 1990s on to 2002. Darren Stewart, who I already identified as Pac-Man for the organization, also identified Ken Clark as a shift runner at the Wentworth Gardens location. Then you fast forward for Ken Clark into 2002, and Ken Clark is starting to run money for the organization and take drug money, drug proceeds for the organization. Tasha Deer, who was a runner, as I already identified, testified that she passed off money on one occasion to Ken Clark at Troy Lawrence's restaurant. And later on, during a stop of Ken Clark, he has $7,500 in his trunk, which is clearly drug proceeds, because what's interesting about this is that while he's being pulled over by law enforcement, has a $7,500 in his trunk, he's on the phone with Troy Lawrence, which was intercepted by law enforcement pursuant to the Title III. And they're talking about, Troy's asking him, is it hid? And Ken Clark's complaining that he doesn't like to do this. Ken Clark was involved for years at the Wentworth Garden location as a shift supervisor. His involvement clearly continued in 2002 when you have Tasha Deer passing out drug proceeds as well as the seizure of $7,500 from his trunk, which if you do the math, even on just the $7,500 that was found in Ken Clark's trunk, that gets you well above the 50 grams of crack cocaine because, again, 1 ounce is about $1,000 of drug proceeds for this organization. Next, moving on to Stacia Smith and some suggestion that she is less culpable than some. And while the judge certainly did take into account people's roles because Tasha Deer, based on the gun charge and her involvement in this conspiracy, was looking at 20 years. She got approximately 21 years. So it wasn't as if every single person was treated the same way. And if you look at the record and you look at the sentencing transcripts, each of these individuals, with the exception of Troy Lawrence, who there's no discretion, the judge made an effort and did, in many instances, go below the guideline range when he had the opportunity to, certainly with Stacia Smith, because he did find, again, that she was responsible or the conspiracy that she was involved in was 1.5 kilograms. But as far as her involvement, there's some suggestion that she wasn't that involved. She was involved as a runner and as managing a stash house for this organization, both at Wentworth Gardens and Claude Court. So that in itself, her involvement involved a number of years. You have Darren Smith, who said that twice a week while they were at Wentworth Gardens, he saw Smith bring crack to the location. Griffin, who was a runner for the organization, testified that he would go to Stacia Smith's house and he would drop off drug proceeds and count those drug proceeds at Stacia Smith's house. And he also testified that Stacia Smith was there when they counted the proceeds. He said he stored and hid cocaine that he would buy on behalf of Troy Lawrence at Stacia Smith's house in a TV or a kitchen cabinet, and then on some occasion Stacia was there. And that the government's brief, they make much of the fact that JT, one of the wholesale distributors to Troy, didn't have conversations in Stacia's apartment about drug deals. That's correct. It took place outside, but it was with Griffin, and Griffin would then bring the the powder cocaine at that point and go in and store it at Stacia Smith's house. Green Sals, who I've explained was involved for a significant period of time, stated that he saw bagged up crack cocaine at Stacia Smith's house, and on occasion Stacia Smith was there. He also testified that while they were at Wentworth Gardens, approximately 100 times she delivered crack cocaine to Wentworth Gardens, the drug spot. Fast forward then to Green Salas being involved in as a shift supervisor again at Claude Court, 20 to 30 times is what he testified to. So she was not a minor player. You have at least one intercepted phone call, one in particular where Troy Lawrence is instructing Smith to bring Green $4,000 worth of crack. There was some suggestion as to what that call means. If you look at the trial transcript, Green Sales was a cooperator. He testified. He explained what that call meant. It was supposed to be $4,000 worth of crack, which is over 100 grams of crack. And lastly, Andre Lawrence and what his involvement is in the conspiracy. Your Honor, the evidence was overwhelming to his involvement as well. Mark Connor, who was another wholesale supplier to Troy Lawrence of cocaine, said that from about 2000 to 2002, he delivered cocaine to Andre Lawrence's house approximately 10 times. Approximately 10 of those times, he saw people bagging up cocaine while he was there. He was unsure whether Andre Lawrence was one of the people packaging cocaine. But then Griffin, who was a runner for the organization, say that he saw Troy cook up crack at Doc's at Andre Lawrence's house, and that Doc was present when he was hiding cocaine, and that he also saw Andre Lawrence packaging up cocaine at that at his residence. And then Green Sales, who was a shift supervisor, testified that Doc's house was used to bag while they were selling out of Wentworth Gardens. So again, all three of these individuals were substantial members of this drug conspiracy, reaching the 1.5 kilograms, let alone the 50 grams necessary for the Apprendi finding, is overwhelming. The evidence is overwhelming that they were involved in 1.5 kilograms. As far as just jumping ahead to Andre Lawrence, also raises the evidence related to the 924C charge. I've just explained how Andre Lawrence's house was used to store and package cocaine while they were at Wentworth Gardens and Claude Court based on the time frames. When law enforcement went into his house, he had two loaded guns. One was loaded in a couch. The other was loaded in a back bedroom, which, as the court pointed out previously, also was a room where there was about $4,000 in cash, which was kept in a safe. Also found in this residence was a bulletproof vest and baggies, which suggests drug packaging at his house, which further supports the trial testimony. Under this court's precedent, that's far and away enough evidence to show that this was in furtherance of the drug trafficking conspiracy and was done to protect that stash house.
What do you say to Mr. Brindley's, Mr. Albert's a temporal argument about the time from when the gun was found, the Dallaire or the guns, and when the trafficking may have occurred?
With all due respect, it's not supported by the record. You have Mark Connor, who testified at trial that around Christmas 2001, he saw Andre Lawrence with a gun in his belt. And keep in mind that Mark Connor is talking about a time period between 2000 and 2002 when he was delivering wholesale quantities of cocaine to Andre Lawrence's house. So I don't know where the two-year span comes from. It wasn't as if Andre Lawrence had gotten out of the conspiracy and said he's going to go into something else. It's just not the case and not supported by the record in this case, Your Honor. And I've addressed Mr. Brindley's argument with respect to the foreseeability. It's just a tremendous amount of crack cocaine that was certainly foreseeable to each of these individual defendants. And if there's no more questions from the court, the government would rest on its brief, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Dallaire. Mr. Strode?
At no time.
At no time? Well, you had asked for 3 minutes. You may have two. Your time had expired earlier.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your indulgence. Let me briefly address the issues with regard to this circuit's case law, Tolliver and Jones. I know specifically Jones, two members of this panel sat on a few years ago. It's quite distinguishable from this case because in that case, the judge actually did make detailed, specific reasonings as to why he sentenced the defendants in that case pursuant to the particular section. In this case, we don't have anything in the record even similar to what occurred in Jones. In Tolliver, I would also add that there were also a very small number of defendants, each of whom were very clearly managers in the case. So again, the point stands as to whether or not Knight still stands. The error in this case that the government contends and frankly glosses over a little bit is again, the judge's belief that he had to sentence all of these defendants under Section A without making any finding. And I would point to tab 1 in our original brief, which is the judge's decision to deny a motion to sentence under Section 841B1C. At the very end, he says, the moving defendants were convicted of the count. The jury found the conspiracy involved more than 50 grams. Therefore, each faces penalties under Section A. There's no middle step that the judge is supposed to determine under United States versus Knight, that the foreseeability amount that the judge must determine for each of these defendants is what then gives him the power to give them the sentence under Section A.
Well, he opens that order on page 1, Mr. Showright, by saying there were no jury findings of any amount of drugs reasonably foreseeable to a specific defendant, right?
That's correct.
Which arguably is in support of your argument.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But when he concludes, as you accurately reflect he did, isn't that in support of Judge Sykes' assessment that it's reasonable to infer that he's reflected on that it hadn't been specifically found, that when he makes his conclusion that was what was in his mind considering the evidence that he heard?
If that were true, Your Honor, I first of all wish you would have said it a number of times.
That's really a relief. You seek a revisiting by Judge Anderson of his assessment on as to each defendant.
At the very least, Your Honor, I believe Judge Anderson should be required to give a specific determination as to why he believed each of these defendants could reasonably foresee these things. And I would again defer to his comments that he felt that some of these defendants were sentenced just above the minimum.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. I want to particularly add an additional thanks on behalf of the court to all appointed counsel who aided the court in the representation of the various defendants. It's much appreciated and it's the greatest asset to the court.